amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, episode number 14 something or other. I'm Steve W, and I've got Steve D with me here to talk about things that have been going on this week. There's been loads that's been happening, and we're ready to get stuck pretty much straight into it. It's been an interesting time in the macro economy. Tencent's reported earnings, Wise has reported earnings, and there's another REIT worth talking about that I've found. And this time, we are actually going to talk about all those things. But first of all, Steve, how are you, and how has your week been in the stock market and outside the stock market?
I've been ill this week, Steve. I was working from home on Monday, and about halfway through the day, I just had to send my boss a text to say, I'm going to bed. I feel awful. And I went to bed, and I didn't emerge until Thursday morning back to work. It was pretty rough, like flu, sort of. I don't really know what it was, but it was not pleasant, but I am feeling much better now in comparison to that. It's not very difficult to feel much better. My wife is still suffering. She's still got a cold. And the other day, the cat, I'm not sure if it was taking the mick out of us or not, just started sneezing itself. So maybe we've managed to pass something on to the cat as well. Just before I go into my stock, Steve, just want to give a bit of praise to Sammy128K on Spotify. Again, I can't respond to messages on Spotify, and I've no idea why they haven't built that feature. It seems very stupid. But the message said, my favorite podcast, did you know as a shareholder that you get 35% off Bloomsbury books? Might be worth doing a segment on shareholder perks. Might be fun in the future. So, I didn't know that we got 35% off Bloomsbury books. And Steve, as another Bloomsbury shareholder, also didn't know that we got 35% off Bloomsbury books. I have approached Trading 212 to be able to access this discount. I've noticed that there's a form that we need to fill out where we need details of our nominee and or our shareholder code, which is essentially a number on the bottom of the share certificate. Now, Trading 212 won't give me the number at the bottom of the share certificate for reasons we've probably explained in numerous occasions below, but they're looking into whether they can give me the nominee details, which I can't imagine would be an issue. If we're allowed to vote using control numbers, I can't imagine it's any different to that. So I will let you know. But yes, if we can get access to that, then maybe it might be worth us doing a segment on the best shareholder perks in the future, Steve. I think that might be pretty interesting.
Legal in general, I think you get a discount on life insurance if you buy from them and you are a shareholder through a similar sort of metric. When I looked into this, Legal in general still wasn't the cheapest available life insurance for me, so it didn't make any actual difference. I'm also not a Legal in general shareholder at the moment, but I was a little while ago and looked at the quotes for life insurance and figured that it was still actually more expensive that way. But yeah, 35% off books, whatever a book is these days, from Bloomsbury sounds interesting. Let's go look into some more stuff that's available. That would be kind of handy, I think.
I know some of the pub brands, you get 10 or 15 percent off your meals. I think you can use them once a month or something like that. So, and that's, I think it's, it used to be Mitchell and Butler or something like that. I can't remember the brand exactly, but yeah, one of them you got a bit of, it might be Marston's. You got a bit of discount off your local Boza meals. But in terms of stocks, Steve, I've had a pretty decent week. I've actually underperformed the S&P, but I don't benchmark against the S&P because, as I was saying, Steve, off air, I use the VWRP. Two reasons, really. That's what I would buy. It's an all-world accumulating index. So that's what I would buy if I wasn't buying individual stocks. And also, it's an easier target at the moment because Roos is off to the races and I quite like to win. But of my 30 positions, so 29 stocks in an ETF, 86.67% of them were in the green this week. VWRP went up 1.14%. So 25 of my stocks beat VWRP, which is 83.33%. I was up on the week, Steve, 1.94%. So it's about a 50% beat there or thereabouts, a bit more than that. But again, S&P was up 2.64 and the NASDAQ was up a very strong 3.06. But Steve, I know somebody who beat both of them.
Yes, you're right. Last week, the boss hog. This week, my portfolio is up higher than both of those two things. I don't benchmark against anything, but I'm up 3.2% this week, mostly due to some fairly favorable macroeconomic shifting that we'll talk about in a little bit because I have suspicions about it. Part of this is to do with the fact that I've been buying a load of REITs lately, and REITs have had a good week or so. They've had a good little bit more than a week, actually. But yeah, 3.2% up this week. The only reason I know that is because Steve made me work it out just before we came on. Yeah. Outside of that, I've had a similar week to you, but slightly less extreme, I think. Get used to this feeling of constantly being ill when you have a little and they will drag germs around and bring them back for you. Alistair's fetched some more home from nursery for us, so I've been battling those this week. I wouldn't have known that you were ill based on your kind of 2-on-2 output. You still managed to, from your kind of sick bed, put your usual level of care and attention and thought into the stuff that you were posting on there, and I still managed to click up on as much of it as I possibly could. And yeah, my wife is also suffering at the moment, but you know, she's married to me. That's just standard stuff. Otherwise, it's busy at work. We're getting into the season where we go for all through the admissions exercise, and that really starts to heat up. So at Oxford, we read quite a lot of forms, and we read some essays and some personal statements and loads of things. And then we have an interview process. That all happens in a really quite condensed window between now and sort of the middle of December. So we don't have long to shortlist. And then after that, the interviews come quite fast. And then there's all the kind of rearranging between the colleges and sorting everything out to do with who's going to be re-interviewed by who, make offers, offer places, and wind it all up again by, well, probably slightly less than that, actually, about 3 weeks from the start now. So we've just got all the test scores in and we need to mark some essays and then sort all that out. That makes life horrendously busy at this time of year. We're also trying to get everything done for the end of term. So directly term ends onto interviews. So everything has to be ready for all of that, which is this is the busy time of the year. It's quite fun the first couple of goes round when you do this sort of thing. Nice to be interviewing, nice to be on the other side of the desk to where I'm usually at for interviews. After a while, it gets quite samey and you realise that there's an awful lot more going on in compliance than there you previously thought, and it mostly gets in the way. But there we are, busy time for work at the moment, and starting to get an eye on Christmas. Black Friday is coming. Steve, have you got your eye on anything for Black Friday, actually, out of interest? I was hearing a bit about this on a podcast recently as well.
I've actually bought something for the Amazon Black Friday 10 days or whatever it is that Amazon have managed to stretch out to this time. I bought some Amazon Alexa. I don't even have Amazon Alexa, but I'm sure I will be able to get them to work. But Amazon Alexa smart plugs. And I bought them because we live in an old house that the previous occupiers have quite over-insulated and put quite thick wall up in the attic, so we tend to get a little bit of condensation here and there where I've not quite managed to strip it all back where it needs to be. So we run a dehumidifier sometimes, and we run one of those two style energy contracts where you get off-peak and on-peak energy, and our off-peak is like a sixth of the cost. So I'm going to get a smart plug to run the dehumidifier at full whack in the middle of the house pretty much all night, rather than, you know, run it at the very expensive cost before it. So and then we got another one because we thought maybe we could benefit from doing something else with this. We'll figure it out when it comes to it. They were only 10 quid or 12 quid, so let's just get a couple and see where we end up. But Steve, my other sort of news, which I completely forgot to mention earlier and I probably should have done, is that we have our due date for the baby, and it'll be the 30th of this month. And it's a C-section, so it's a planned C-section. So it should be on that day. We're in at 7 o'clock in the morning. Hopefully that means we can get a parking space this time. And so expect news around that kind of time if I'm managed to recover from blubbering like an idiot.
Mark it in your diaries, ladies and gents. It's not far away, the 30th of November. And then expect a couple of pre-recorded things coming in the near future. But on the subject of smart plugs, actually, I got two of those, free from my energy supplier, which is OVO. I signed up to this thing called the OVO Power Move, which sounds like something you see at the Tory party conference, to be honest. But What it is if you use more than, or if you keep your energy in that peak period between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. when the grid is at its, I don't know, ungreenest, brownest, whatever it is, you get 15 quid back on your energy bills. We managed that recently, I think mostly because I insisted on running the tumble dryer at full tilt for all the other hours of the day. And I think that mostly worked out as free tumble drying with 15 quid back. But that also came with two free smart plugs that I'm currently working out how to plug in and connect, and also what I want them for. But that'll be, we'll see how they work. They might be useful for while we're away for turning on lights and stuff at various random times of the day. Anyway, your very important news aside, that's enough from us for the time being. Steve, what have you been consuming this week?
So just an article this week, Steve. There is a few things I've consumed this week, because when you're laid in your bed and you're feeling pretty sick, you tend to listen to a lot of things. So, because we were intending to speak about the Wise earnings call and the Tencent earnings call, I've stripped them from my things I was consuming, and because the other thing I consumed just made me mad, it's probably better that we don't do a running theme of me just being mad at things I read on the internet. So here's something I was really, really happy about reading on the internet, and it's by somebody you'll probably hear a lot of in the future in one of our pre-recorded episodes, is a guy called Alex from The Science of Hitting. He's he was a proper analyst, if you want to call him that, at a proper firm, but then left to cover about 10 or 12 stocks himself in detail for subscribers of his service. And it's all behind a big paywall, and it's a fairly inexpensive service, but again, it's not something I've paid for. I like to follow him on Twitter, The Science of Hitting, because he posts some of the best graphs I've ever seen. And they're graphs about things that you wouldn't think about graphing, but when he graphs them, they make a lot of sense, and they're really good to refer to. And you, I think I've posted them up in the video a few times here if you watch on YouTube. He has an article about Disney, which is one of the stocks he covers, called, I think it's called something The Turning Point. I'm sure there's more of it at the beginning about this, but it's, we will link it in the description. And he's made it free at the moment, just to kind of give you an idea of the quality of his research, which you'll find if you watch it, is really, really high. And he goes through the various segments of Disney's DTC, which is Disney Plus essentially, and their other offerings that go with it, and talks about how they'll work once they're combined, what margins could look like, the direction that Disney are going in, the direction that he thinks Disney should go in, and what the future looks like for the whole of the sort of DTC service at Disney. And it's a really, really good article. It's really well thought out. You can see that he spent some time, sat pen in his mouth, thinking about how this works out for Disney. And he gives you the ideal case, and he gives you the worst case scenario of the two. And then starts making comparisons to all the competitors as well, so you can see just how far along Disney are and where they need to be to meet these goals. So I thought it was a really, really interesting article. I shared it in as many places as I could find it once it came out, and I hope people got some benefit of it. But for those who just listen to the podcast and aren't in any of the communities that we have, it'll be in the description for you. And I, Disney shareholder or thinking about becoming a Disney shareholder, I think it's well worth a read.
Yeah, more than that, even if you're just interested in thinking about businesses and what sorts of things make businesses good and strong and constitute competitive advantages and that kind of thing, well worth a look on this, because it is Disney specific, and you will get more from it if you are either a Disney shareholder or interested in Disney shares for some reason. But in general, with these kind of really good in-depth dives into businesses, it's as much about what you learn about the business kind of structurally as it is about the specifics of the thing, at least sometimes I find. Anyway, which actually brings me to my thing I've consumed, which is, it's nice, by the way, your one, because it's not a podcast. We talk about a lot of podcasts on this because we do consume a lot of podcasts, and there are a lot of very good podcasts around. But sometimes we do actually kind of read things as well, whether they're email newsletters or blog posts or the kind of thing you're looking at there. But here's what I've got, and it is another podcast. So it's the Business Breakdowns podcast. The most recent one is on Coca-Cola, which is a company that I am not interested in buying at the moment. It's not a million billion miles above a level where I'd take an interest in it at the moment, but it's about sort of 10-15% higher than I'd like it for now. So I wouldn't rule it out if things went down sharply, but are not right now, and I'm not looking terribly closely right now. That said, if you want to know about what makes this company better than all of its other kind of similar-ish drink-producing companies, this is a really good thing to listen to. It's from a guy called Freddie Late, who is the founder and managing partner at Latitude Investment Management. Don't know much about that firm particularly. But lots of interesting stuff. Here's the bit I'll kind of zoom in on for the time being. One thing weighing on shares like Coca-Cola or Kraft Heinz or various similar US-focused food-ish products. Both of those are food-ish, by the way. Neither of them produces any actual food. Is this stuff about drugs and anti-obesity drugs. So GLP-1s, they are currently compressing multiples because people are worried in this sector about what will happen to the amount of Kraft Heinz stuff that people eat or the amount of Coke that people drink, especially in America when these things become a bit more mainstream than they are. And I liked the section very much that he had on the risk of GLP-1s going forward. You can agree or disagree with this, and I think I disagree in quite a few places, but look, if you're trying to work out how to get started thinking about this sort of thing, it's a good way to go here. So think about what this kind of means for, he's thinking of Coke, so let's stay there for the moment. Okay, so about 40% of Americans are technically or classified as obese. You can make of that what you will based on Americans and based on measurements of obesity and so on, but 40% is roughly the number that he's got in mind here. And of that, roughly how many are going to be able to access this drug is the next question. Probably about half, because it's expensive. About half of them won't have the financial backing or power themselves to access GLP-1s further in the future. And about half of that, if you come off it, you tend to go right back to where you were before. So these tend to be lifetime commitment things. And if you think about half of the people will fall off that wagon one way or another, you get to a point where you're looking at around, so half 40 for the obesity things to get you to access to 20, around half that to get you to around 10. Maximum sort of 10% or so, with some reasonably bullish assumptions for the drug, for how many people will stay on it. That's possibly around a 5% revenue hit to Coke. So if that comes on in the next sort of 3 or 4 years or so, then our revenues will have pushed higher by 3 or 4 or 5% by that time. So you might think the hit there is reasonably minimal, is his kind of general thesis. A couple of areas I'd try and contest on this, but I do think this is a good way to think about it. Of what size of market are you looking at? How many are going to spend on it? How many are going to stick to it? When's it going to come? Those all seem like the right questions, is why I'm kind of bigging this up. I'm a little bit dubious, by the way, that you can run the numbers quite that simply for a couple of reasons. One is that I think the 40% obese percentage of Americans make up a disproportionately high amount of the revenue at either Coke or Kraft Heinz. I don't think the unobese spend as much on those products as the obese do. So I think that's more than kind of, I don't think you can just distribute that across the entire population and think the revenue is even there. So I'm iffy on that point. I'm also iffy on the point that revenue, even if it does grow to offset that decline in the next 3 years, there's still things like inflation to look at here. You'd look for better, at the current price anyway, which is the case with Coke, and I think anyway is not the case with Kraft Heinz. I think I'd be looking for a bit more growth than that, even to offset a 5% revenue headwind here. In fairness, in the rest of the podcast, he talks about lots of areas where that growth might come from, in his view anyway. You can take or leave that. He's not simply saying there is no kind of threat or challenge here because we'll outgrow it. There's genuinely a sense in which a 5% headwind would be a quite significant revenue headwind. But I think this is a good way to be thinking about this. You can agree with his assumptions, disagree with them, agree with mine, disagree with them too. Where the truth is, I don't really know. But as someone who was looking at this and thinking, I wonder what I make of this as a kind of challenge from a Kraft Heinz perspective, I thought this was really helpful as a way of helping me to get started in thinking about what the impacts of this might be and what I ought to value the business at accordingly, based on the kind of potential impact of these sorts of things. This is, in general, a podcast series that you're quite a fan of, Steve. Business Breakdowns, both you and I have listened to several of these, possibly different ones in some cases, because I haven't listened to them all by any manner or means, but I generally think they've all been quite high quality. Did you have any thoughts on GLP-1s or anything like that going forward?
So we did Eli Lilly before, didn't we? Because we did it about being the... was it the $100 billion drug or the trillion dollar drug or whatever it was? And I have thought about this quite a lot, and my thinking is, where's the biggest opportunity? Is the biggest opportunity in the fear, or is the biggest opportunity in just going out and buying a basket of Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly and sat there, or perhaps combining them together to make a threat versus solution kind of basket and maybe winning that way. So interesting topic. I just think that I don't know enough about either, really, to get myself over the line with either the brand or with the or the drug, although the drug does sound really, really promising, and as a lazy bastard, if it helps you lose loads of weight, I'm totally for it. So I don't know, Steve. Business Breakdowns is a great podcast. If you're not subscribed to it, you should be. Even though sometimes you're going to get a company in there that you're not particularly interested in, they're still worth a listen, because you come out with some sometimes business specific, but sometimes broader than that, knowledge of the industry that you can impress your friends with, Steve, and start your own podcast. What do you think?
Yeah, but don't try and steal the ideas off of this show, because they're not as good as any other ones. So I guess two lots of consumption then, where we're thinking about sort of things that are relevant to companies that we are sort of interested in one way or another, but also these are smart guys and there's a lot of learning to be had from some of these and the way they look at them. And you can agree or disagree with them, by the way, but just the things that they think about, and pointing out that here are the things you ought to have some sort of idea about if you want to be an owner in, well, these companies, or things that are adjacent and in this kind of industry or sector more broadly, is our contribution for this week. Shall we move ahead, Steve? Before we move on, a quick one from Steve and me. If you're enjoying the show, please do give us a like, a comment, and a rating on whatever platform you're listening on. And make sure you share the podcast with your investing friends. It helps us a lot, and we're really looking forward to building out something that you guys can get some value from and that we can have some fun in making. So do like, subscribe, and back on with the show.
The sucker's going up.
Okay, next thing. For the first time in a few weeks now, we're talking about macroeconomics and things that have been happening at the kind of macro level. The reason we haven't talked about this sooner is mostly because Steve and I rarely have anything particularly insightful to add on this. And that's still the case this week, but we haven't done it in a little while and lots has been happening. So it's worth a kind of update and maybe just a kind of guide as to where we're thinking. So let's go back just over a week or so, because we're recording this on a Saturday. But last week there was big news on the UK GDP. Last Friday it was announced that UK GDP had grown by 0%. It had grown, but it had grown by less than 8%. So fending off again for another quarter the sort of fears of a recession, GDP continues to move forward according to the ONS, albeit an absolute crawl. This appeared to get quite a lot of excitement from what I could see of it. We are the kind of country that celebrates moving forward under 1% in terms of our productivity. This is very exciting for the UK. Despite the fact that, by the way, we were 0.2% in Q1 and 0.1% in Q2, and now we're not, we are going in the wrong direction growth-wise, but nonetheless, we are growing. After that, out came news on Tuesday of earlier this week from the US. News was around inflation, which was down to 3.2%. It was 3.7% beforehand, and it had been getting stuck there a little bit for the US. That's almost double their kind of 2% target, 3.7%, even though, you know, when you've been looking and thinking about 6 and 7%, 3.2 doesn't seem like an awful lot now. And I thought I caught Jack Howe on the Barron Streetwise podcast this week, talking about the idea that consumer goods companies that have been raising prices to kind of fend off inflation, well, they weren't going to bring them back down. Now inflation was slowing. That's going to stay up there. And was that going to run beyond consumers' ability to spend? A couple of things there. No, they're not bringing them back down with 3.2% inflation. Their prices are still going up. If you want to kind of match inflation here, you have to keep pushing them up just at a slower rate. So I was not convinced that a lower inflation number, I mean, that still means prices going up. It just means not going up as fast. So anyway, 3.2% for the US, which is kind of close to the 2% target that both the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England have. And I was really worried at this point that the UK was about to get left in the dust, because we were way, way higher. We were still at 6.7% on Tuesday. And then the UK inflation data came out on Wednesday, and it's 4.6%, which is quite a lot higher than 3.2, but nowhere near 6.7. So it's coming down quite a bit. And that allies with a pretty strong jobs report that says, for the first time in however long, wages going up faster than inflation. Mine aren't, nor are my wife's. They haven't gone anywhere recently. But wage growth currently outstripping inflation, and a big lump taken out of the inflation number as well, down from 6.7 to 4.6%. That's with the US recently deciding for about the last three goes round to hold rates fixed at 5.5% and the UK holding them fixed at 5.25%, because we kind of copy what the US does, but just like slightly worse, basically. Our inflation did manage to get down in a kind of noticeable way, albeit not to the level of the US and not really anywhere near the US. But the UK's been battling headwinds the US hasn't, to do with oil and energy and so on. But Steve, any thoughts on any of this? The market's been liking it very, very much. This is why stuff has been going higher. This is why I've been having a good week in REITs. Actually, banks have fared fairly well too.
Yeah, I think, it's good news, but it sort of hides some bad news as well, I think, when you look through the figures. So inflation is still pretty high. I mean, the rate for food and non-alcoholic beverages is still over 10. It's 10.1% in October 2023. And inflation rate at restaurants and cafes is still 8.8%. And 4 in 10 adults are now spending more to get their usual food shop than they were just last year. So it's not good news, it's partially good news. It's not as good news as the market seems to think it is. It's still massively expensive, and massively expensive rises in costs. And to say that they're expecting, I mean, Cathy was on the other week saying that deflation is coming, blah, blah, blah. And if deflation comes, then we maybe should see some reduction in prices. But at the moment, in terms of food and eating out and cafes and drink, you're nowhere near deflation. You're absolutely nowhere near. So where we are seeing a little bit of deflation, obviously, is in the gas price, which has fallen about 31%, but that should happen because that's cyclical. Motor prices have fallen about 7.6% as well. So, but 49% of adults are using less fuel in their home, probably because of the sort of scare we got last year with the sort of gas and electricity prices, and obviously the removal of the sort of government subsidy scheme that we had. I know I'm definitely one who's having the heating on less. We still haven't got the heating on its sort of schedule. I think we're prepping ahead for the 30th when the heating will be on 24/7. But yeah, look, it's hard to criticize the report. I mean, to see Rishi and Jeremy Hunt out there trying to claim that this was some kind of victory for the political party is ridiculous. It's nothing more than sort of tough comps and high interest rates. It's certainly nothing to be out and celebrate. You know, this, and the public is wising up to this as well. Because I saw a post out the other day that said, "Did Rishi Sunak, did the good man Rishi Sunak do this, or is this natural?" And I think 99% of people have ticked the natural box from about 30,000 votes. So I'm glad to see that people aren't just giving people baseless credit for stuff. But yes, Steve, I mean, we don't talk about inflation very much because we don't have a lot on it, so especially not of any great value. But my value here is that the sort of gas prices and fuel prices falling are masking what is still very high inflation for the stuff we actually use more often in the UK.
That's interesting. My main takeaway from this wasn't on the inflation side here. I see enthusiasm about this, and from what I was reading about market commentary, I agree with your kind of final, I guess, concluding thought, although you kind of stuck it in the middle, which is that markets are too excited by this. Markets are reading this more positively than either I would or you would. And I'm okay with the inflation-y stuff, but the market's now starting to say, okay, forget any ideas about rate hikes and pauses and so on. When's the first cut coming? And you have a choice. You can be sort of fairly bullish and you can think it's coming in the middle of next year. You can be really, really bullish and think it's coming at the end of this year, which is like in the next month or so. And I don't see that happening at all, but some people do. If you wanted some examples of overenthusiasm in the market, there's people who think that. Or you can listen to what the Bank of England says and think it's coming in 2025. And I'm not saying, therefore, it is. The Bank of England is more than capable of saying one thing and doing another thing, either because it doesn't really know what it's doing or because the facts around it change. And therefore, it decides something happens next year that causes a cut to come sooner or rates to go higher. Fair enough. But this, to me, is... This sort of flashes danger signs to me a little bit here. When the market gets more enthusiastic than I am, I start to worry a little bit. I think the real thing that's kind of looking slightly suspicious to me is this falling trend in GDP growth. It's been down quarter on quarter as inflation comes down. And so it's impossible to talk about GDP growth and not mention your prediction for the start of the year, which is that we avoid recession. And I think that's pretty much in. Of course, your prediction expires at midnight on December 31st, which is looking pretty good right now. Of course, our portfolios don't, and our lives don't, and our investing doesn't. So we need to be interested in what's going to happen after that. And it looks to me like slowing GDP growth is creeping towards recession territory. That's not a big surprise. That's the risk of what happens if you try and bring down inflation by hiking interest rates. But I would not call this soft landing territory yet for two reasons. One is that we're not at the 2% target thing, so I'm tempted to say we haven't landed. And the other is I'm not saying the signs of a recession are off the table by any means yet. I think that's getting more likely, not less. And that makes me a little bit wary. On the inflation stuff and the unevenness of it, I was listening to a Goldman Sachs analyst who works on consumer product stuff in general, so including staples and discretionary, but they were talking mostly about discretionary. And what they were saying is, if you kind of divide the market into, this is not their words, these are mine, but here's the point they were making. If you imagine kind of consumer discretionary in sort of four segments, so there's services and goods along one kind of axis, or plot your way along that, and big ticket, low ticket along another one. So you've got kind of four quadrants, right? Big ticket services, big ticket goods, low ticket services, low ticket goods. The thing that really looks like it's taking some pressure at the moment, and maybe this is predictable, is big ticket goods. High ticket stuff is holding up okay in services, so stuff like holidays and that sort of thing. I'm a bit wary as to how long that's got to hold up with the US consumer where it is. But low ticket stuff like something like McDonald's or Starbucks is considered discretionary, but it's not an expensive sort of discretionary. It's not like yachts and boats and RVs and that sort of thing. The lower end is holding up fairly well. The higher end, especially in the goods quadrants, coming under pressure. And that's a theme they see continuing into next year. I think they're right about that, but I think the kind of pressure is more likely to spread out than just concentrate itself on that big ticket goods area.
Yeah, agree with you there, Steve. I think one of the things we saw on Friday was when the spending report came out and showed that despite prices rising pretty heavily, actual spending is falling now. So I think we are heading towards that slowdown come recession. But luckily for the UK, the Tories have just found about 15 billion headroom in the budget, so from extra tax receipts. So I would expect that there'll be some kind of stimulus for the retail sector, be that tax cuts or something along those lines, or maybe a VAT cut in retail. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But I think America is vastly different. I mean, it was pointed out to me the other day that America, despite its GDP growing at like, you know, a couple of percent, it's spending about 11% more than it was last year on its budgets. So, you know, it's only natural when you're spending about 11% more on your budgets that the economy would grow. But obviously, if you think you remove that 11% and see what 2-3% growth, there's an 8% deficit in there somewhere, which is about what you would expect when somebody raises rates from 0 to 5 and 5.25 in such a short period of time. So interesting to see that. The other interesting thing, Steve, that I spotted this week was for the first time in about 15 years now, rail rates at your bank are above inflation. So you can now actually make a rail return from a savings account, which is, which, I mean, it won't last very long, but that's something to celebrate, I guess. Any more on that, Steve, or do you want to shuffle on?
One last thing then. So yeah, you're right. This is a kind of temporary halt in what we might call financial repression, which is to say getting poorer by keeping your money. I think all of that's kind of broadly right. We're 6 weeks away from this really being important to either Steve or me, but I think next year is going to be a tough one for predictions a little bit. So both Steve and I are sort of reasonably bearish given where the market is at the moment and given where the underlying kind of macro fundamentals are. That said, it's a double election year next year in both the UK and the US, and that can make things go kind of skewy to the bullish side. And that is going to be, I think, something hard for us to kind of consider as we try and tackle predictions for next year.
Yeah, EU elections as well next year. I think sure 80% enough, of the 80% of the developed world is holding an election next year.
Ouch. So there'll be lots to talk about then, and we'll find some interesting people to talk about it with as well, unless of course Paul is back from his constant state of war that he finds himself in. Okay, Steve, tell us about TransferWise. They've been reporting some earnings, and those numbers look pretty big that you were showing me.
Quite impressive, Steve, to be honest with you. It led to the question of why don't I own this at the end of when I went down the figures, went through the call. And I rectified that, Steve. I actually went out and bought it. I only bought a £500 position in it. It's a small position, less than 1% in the portfolio, less than 0.5% in the portfolio. Quite an impressive set of results. So I'll shoot through them, and I've tried my best to simplify them where possible. They're very confusing because they use the word income loads of times. So they like to use net income, but they also like to use interest income, and they also like to use income, which means total revenue. So I've changed some of the headings to try and make them a little bit more easy to understand. But here's the financials anyway. So the revenue came in at $498 million. This is for the half, by the way, and that was up 25%. Interest income was $158 million. That was up 848%, which you would expect because rates are now at 5% and a bit. Total revenue, so adding them both together, $656 million plus 58%. Gross profit, $489 million plus 86%. Adjusted EBITDA was $241 million, which is up 163%. Net income came in at $141 million, plus 277%. Free cash flow, Steve, of $229 million on the half. That's up 194%. And that gives you a free cash flow conversion from EBITDA. And I've put a massive exclamation mark next to this one, Steve, of 95%. Very, very, very impressive from Wise. So in terms of geography, so Asia Pacific was 102 million plus 39%. Europe was 152 million plus 18%. North America, 103 million plus 21%. UK was 96 million plus 19%. And rest of the world was 45 million plus 53%. In terms of business metrics, the revenue take rate was 87 basis points. Cross-border revenue was 384 million. That was up 20%. And cross-border take rate was 67 basis points, which is actually up 5 basis points from the last time we saw a report. Other revenue was 114 million. That's plus 48%. And I had a look at what this was because I wasn't entirely sure. But it's basically interchange from the Wise card. So when you go out and spend the Wise card generally, they get a little kickback from the merchant fee, and that's what this revenue is. In terms of a take rate, it's 0.2%. Right, okay, so cross-border payment volume was 57.4 billion, that's up 12%, of which 42.3% of it was personal, and that was up 11%, and business was 15 billion plus 13%. Customer base is up to 7.2 million users. That was up 32%. Wise card spend was up 90% over the last report. So using multiple features, personal was up 44% of users from 32%. Business was up to 58% from 53%. Two-thirds of new customers joined via word of mouth, Steve. So they had literally no acquisition costs on those people. They announced a launch of Swift correspondent services, which I'll talk about a little bit more because they gave a lot more detail of that on the call. And they said that their market share is still really small, Steve. 5% personal and less than 1% of small and medium businesses who are sending money abroad. So very impressive list of stats. Just another one, Steve, just to round off the stats really, was growing customer balances, 12.3 billion, up 33%. So yeah, impressive. So Wise Platform now has some new platform partners. Some we'll have heard of, some we won't, Steve, but they have Interactive Brokers now, Bluevine, IndusInd Bank, which is Industrial India Bank, I think. I think they've shortened it. GMO, Azora Net Bank, and the Saudi Awal Bank. And then they have some new non-bank partners, which was Moomoo, Crossbend, Parpera, and Agoda. I think some of those are brokers in different countries. I definitely recognize Moomoo as a Chinese broker. In terms of outlook, Steve, they said that they're expecting the income to grow at between 33 and 38% full year 24. That was actually raised from 28 to 33%. So quite a hefty raise in income expectation there. And the medium-term guidance was unchanged, which is income growth at 20% CAGR over the medium term and EBITDA margins of about 20%, remaining elevated if rates are over 1%. So the call was really good, Steve. I mean, do you want to go over the figures before I go over the call? I've got a lot from the call, or do you want me to keep going?
Let's pick up for a moment then with some figures. I mean, to start with your kind of question to yourself, which is why don't you own this thing? I think the reason historically has been it's been quite expensive, or at least it's looked quite expensive to the kind of numbers that it has. But this is a good example, I think, of a case where if you are growing quite quickly, it doesn't really matter if you trade at large-ish multiples of stuff, because you're probably worth that, or it's not hard to see how you can be worth that. And when we look at where they are at the moment, I have them marked at around a 34 price earnings ratio, and they're guiding for 33% growth. That gets you to a PEG ratio of around 1. So if you think they're going to grow by about a third, you can knock about a third off that 34 thing, which takes you down to around... Yeah, it takes you into the 20s, basically. Close to 20. You can call it 22. Nearest makes no difference here. 22 times earnings, and they have a market share of 5% and 1% in personal to small, medium enterprise business. There's room to run there, and their service is really, really good. We talked about the Business Breakdowns podcast. If you want an idea of why their service is good and what the obvious benefit to kind of end users is, and the bigger they get, the more likely they be, the more the better reason there comes to kind of sucker people onto their exchange and so on. This is a good place to be kind of looking here. It feels kind of Adyen-like, which is quite lazy because they're both a kind of fintech sort of company here. But the more they grow, the more reason there is to join them. There's a networking benefit there, and they are growing pretty well at the moment from what I can see of it, Steve. But yeah, sorry, back to the earnings call.
If we have to make an acquisition call this year, Steve, this is going to be my acquisition call, because somebody's going to look at this and go, I don't understand why I shouldn't own this. Do you know what I mean? We're looking at, I'm thinking Visa's, your MasterCard. Somebody like that is going to look at this and say, you know, we should own this.
Yeah, it seems more a MasterCard thing than a Visa thing, right? MasterCard seems a little bit more dynamic, a little bit more forward-looking. I think you're looking at someone of maybe that size. It's got about a 7 billion market cap. You're going to struggle to take it out at that level. That's close to, what, $9 billion or $8 billion? You'd need a fair bit of change lying around for this. But, yeah, something like MasterCard might be an interesting idea for that.
Yeah, definitely. So the call was good as well, Steve, because they're really good at explaining the business and they're not worried about... saying things in there that I think that some businesses would try and hide and not comment on. So you always get a decent amount of information in the call. But I've got about 17 points that I found in the call, so I'm just going to rattle through them and then I'll pass back to you again, Steve. So point one was they said that they're currently benefiting from the tailwind of higher interest rates. So in case you couldn't tell that, but they said that eventually interest rates will come off. And these will become tough comps, and then we could have year-on-year declines. It's something to be aware of, just becoming more cyclical to the upside due to the cyclicality of the interest income. Point two, they said that higher interest income was boosting income growth, resulting in near-term higher profit margins, and just to be wary of that when you're building your models. Number three was near-term higher adjusted EBITDA margins remain high due to higher interest income and unable to share that excess interest income at an 80% level with their customers. So one of the things they'd like to do is take that adjusted EBITDA number and share 80% of that level back with their customers. But they're not actually able to do so at the moment because of regulatory and licensing problems. So they're saying about 37% adjusted EBITDA margin is much higher than they guided previously, and it's a function of two major drivers. First, that they weren't able to share the excess interest back with the customers at the level they aspire to as per their framework, But partly it's a function of what their licenses allow them to pay out in various reasons. But if you subbed all of that off, Steve, their adjusted EBITDA margin would have still been 29%, even if they achieved this framework. So it's still a very healthy, strong business, which isn't completely interest rate dependent. So number four was Wise was not dependent on high interest rates to make money. It's just that when it happens, it becomes more beneficial. So structurally, the way their products are working means that they will only become dependent on about 1% of interest. But also, like with higher interest rates, you'll see higher profit margins, and we're already seeing flow through. So I just thought that was pretty interesting, just to sort of drill down on the area. And again, to show you that this is the company that aren't worried about talking about, you know, the sort of pitfalls of the future when the interest rates drop back down. So they said macro remains uncertain and has resulted in lower volume per customer, but they expect it to persist into full year 2024 and beyond. Growth rates also have tough first half of 23 comps as well, just to note that. They said our growth rate also reflects a notably tough comparative period in half one full year 23, which benefited substantially from higher activity related to the strength of the USD, which I think you'll remember back in the first half of 23, Steve. The dollar was on a bit of a rampage. Growing infrastructure mode of connecting direct, it allows us to remove intermediaries, so it makes it cheaper and faster, and that's what's difficult to replicate. So onto licensing and connectivity, they said, we fundamentally believe in connecting directly to more and more payment systems. So each country has its own payment system, and if you can connect directly to it, that gives you access to that full payment network in that country. So direct connectivity gives Wise two things. It gives them instant speeds that the customers are absolutely wowed by, and that makes customers evangelical about the product, which means that you get better customer acquisition costs because you get word of mouth. And they said that they've just added Australia into direct integration, so they've got direct integration into Australia's payment system, which is called NPP. That allows them to provide cheaper and faster payments to Australians, but it also gives them complete independence in that market, so Wise can go forward and operate without needing to use like sort of intermediaries in the territory. They were talking about the US. They said that they don't have any direct connection in the US. They operate on a network of partners. And they explained this because simply they have to add redundancy in their network by having multiple partners of all the products in the major markets. But the regulation in the US is that you have to be a bank to get access, to get direct access to the US payment network. And that's not something they want to do. So they're going to work with partners in the US. So they gave some stats, Steve. So Wise is faster than every competitor that serves that territory. So 81% of Wise customers receive their money within 1 hour. 95% receive it within 24 hours. And that's versus 2 to 4 days. And it's also cheaper, Steve. So the average in Wise is 67 basis points. The average on the competitors is between 3 and 4%. So massively, massively faster and massively cheaper. They said they're very, very proud of the numbers beyond this instant number. 81% of the transfers make it to the destination within 1 hour, 95% within a day. Compare that to a traditional setup where most transfers will still take 2 to 4 days to show up on the other side. Talking about price, they're significantly cheaper and low cost than banks. 0.67 is our average right now compared to 3 to 4 for most banks in most markets, which means that there's no better alternative. People tell us accessing the finances and moving money around borders is tough. It's slow, inconvenient, and expensive. But beyond that, overall, the international banking proposition really doesn't exist at a global scale, so such that you can manage your lives in different countries and in different currencies. So this, they went on to say that they had a huge market that's still available to them. There's no other good alternative to Wise. Wise has a very low market share. Wise was pretty small and has a long way to go. And just to give you an idea, GBP cross-border is about 2 trillion a year for consumers and about another 9 trillion that moves cross-border for businesses, and that's small and medium businesses. So they've got less than 5% share of that in the UK with plenty more potentially to come. So on to SWIFT. Why SWIFT? And it's simply because that the larger banks are already connected to SWIFT. It's difficult to shift SWIFT. SWIFT's build to an API one. So they said, you are right. A lot of the traditional larger banks, they're already connected to SWIFT and they partner with SWIFT. And this allows us then to become a viable option for them to move their flows to us when they want to use our network. And actually, this is not designed in a vacuum. It was designed by the feedback that we got when we were talking to banks, when they said, we love what you're doing and we can see that the infrastructure is powerful. But for us to do heavy lifting and shift on an API integration, which smaller banks can move faster on, it's not really feasible because it's a lot of build for us. And this was one way for them to start testing and using our network, even for maybe some groups versus moving all of their flows. So really interesting little thing there, little sort of like a massive growth vector there, because they went on to give you some stats on Swift, Steve, which is 150 trillion in annual flows through Swift. So it's a massive opportunity, even if they only get a fraction of that market. So interesting to see that. And they are already seeing early inbounds for Swift. So they launched the correspondent services and they're now getting some inbounds from banks, but they did say, you know, be steady, it's still early days. And they still think that rather than using Swift, a lot of the smaller banks, the neobanks, your Monzos, your Starlings, etc., they're going to use Wise's API integration rather than go through Swift. So yeah, Steve, that was the call. I thought it was a really interesting call. I think Wise is a very interesting business. I think the revenues are growing strongly, customer base is growing strongly. I think there is a bit of a weaker average spend at the moment, but volume is definitely sort of countering that lower average spend. So I think interest rates come off. I think you've got to think of interest rates as sort of like a cherry on the top of the cake rather than the cake itself. So yeah, I think it's building a bit of an infrastructure moat here. I think it's becoming difficult to replicate. I think it's cheaper and faster, and that's a big problem for competitors. I ran it through my DCF, Steve, and from, you know, if the model is correct from here, it only needs to grow at about 7% a year to generate a good 10% return. If you're in the camp of higher for longer, Steve, then, you know, this should be easy for you if customer balances, customers and volume continue to grow. And I mean, even if you're not in the higher for longer camp, Steve, I think it could stand as a hedge against the rest of your portfolio just in case it happens. Any thoughts?
Higher for longer is interesting here. So taking a couple of themes together, both from their thing and the way you summarized there at the end, I've written down from the first part of your kind of presentation, 155 million from interest income and 498 million from everything else revenue, basically. So you're looking at interest income here in a what we might call a good year, because that was up something like 800 and whatever percent. Is less than 25% of total revenues here. So I would view the threat to that, go back to what I was thinking about with Coke before. I think the threat there is sort of reasonably minimal. That might come off a bit, but it can't put a huge dent into revenues. It could slow growth a little bit, but I think the bigger issue or the bigger thing to focus on here is what happens with that other 498 million. And I think the risk there, insofar as there is one, is basically recession and payments slowing down and payment volumes slowing down. So if I was looking for risks here, I wouldn't be too concerned about the idea that interest rates are going to be, I suppose we're wrong about higher for longer. I'm kind of on the higher for longer side, actually. But I sort of think there's going to be a good amount of, even if we're wrong about that, I don't see this as a kind of huge real story on this sort of thing. So what I had written down in kind of big letters, which is where you were heading towards the end, was scale. And connecting to Swift helps with scale. What this company really needs, I think, is scale. So they're faster and cheaper, and we've talked about that point before. That only matters to an extent if they can kind of replicate the sort of, or get something like the sort of scale that will make them a kind of generally global, significant kind of operation here. And it looks like they're working towards doing that. The Swift thing is important in that regard. Swift, by the way, people might have heard of as a thing that Russia was getting kicked out of around the time of the start of the Ukraine war as a way of trying to shut down their sort of financial system or annex their financial system from the rest of the world. That kind of matters here. A lot of the kind of stuff that they were offering in terms of stats, I just put a question mark next to. They point out how much faster they are than the average. That by itself doesn't automatically mean they're the fastest. There's room for more than one thing to be faster than average. So even if they are significantly faster than average, that doesn't so far tell me that there's a compelling case for thinking they're fastest. If they are fastest, and I'm happy to believe they are, then the thing that matters now is being able to do this at scale, and that will make them a kind of really compelling proposition. Because at the moment, they feel like a faster, cheaper, better alternative to the banks, and that came out a lot in the Business Breakdowns podcast. What they need to be able to do is handle the kind of volumes here that will support that sort of growth, and they are working their way towards that kind of thing. The EBITDA stuff and sharing that back was interesting to me. So I guess what we're looking at kind of in the sort of more normal times and when those comps sort of roll off, they were saying 29% EBITDA margin. They currently convert 95% of that. I'm not sure how well that cash conversion number holds up, but you're looking at pretty close to then 29% sort of cash flow margin when we're looking at a kind of business in its final form, as it were. Building out scale here is the thing. I think that was the thing that really caught my eye here. I'm not too worried about interest rates for this company. I get that they flag that as a headwind because $155 million is worth kind of considering here. But I think I would focus on the kind of bigger part of this where I was looking for risks and wonder about, in the short term, a recession. That might not be the worst thing if you think that in general payment processors or in general companies, when they're hit by headwinds, the stronger ones tend to do better. This might just allow them to kick their kind of advantage ahead a little bit because their balance sheet looks good. They'll come through this just fine. The only question is when, and if a kind of intrinsic setback strengthens their relative position, that might be good for the long term, even if it's not so good for the short term. But that's where I'd really be thinking about this business, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, and it's just key to remember that when you're subbing off net interest income, if you want to lose that as part of your scheme, if you think rates go back to zero, you've also got to lose some costs as well because they pay some of that out to their customers. So it comes off the top, and you'll be able to add some of that back in on the bottom as well. So, I think it's a super interesting business, Steve. Just acutely aware we're running out of time. Do you want to do your REIT?
Yeah, I promised people I'd talk about a REIT, so let's do
Tencent as well after it. Let's just make it a long show.
Sure, let's make it a long show, but we won't spend too long on either of these because my thoughts about this REIT are similar to a number of my other thoughts about REIT. So this time I'm looking at something called the Alternative Income REIT. So far in the last roughly month or so, maybe 6 weeks, it feels like about a month, I've talked about three UK REITs. They have been the PRS REIT, which is a sort of housing REIT that buys houses off developers and leases them out to people. Supermarket Income REIT, which was last week, which is fairly obviously supermarkets. And Primary Health Properties, which is another UK bunch, but this time focusing on things like GP surgeries and health centres. What they all have in common is they are all kind of pure plays. They're all focused on one type of building, so whether that's healthcare or whether that's supermarkets or whether that's housing. The one I'm looking at here with the Alternative Income REIT is much, much more diversified, and it's also much, much, much smaller. It has a £53 million market cap. And that means that it's hard to write about if you write for the Motley Fool, because we have a hard floor of 50 million, and below that you're allowed to write information only articles, and no one's interested in an information only article on a stock they've never heard of. So it makes it very unpopular to write about. But below that, we start getting concerned about the idea that there is a genuine concern that we might somehow nudge volumes in a way that make a meaningful difference to the share price. Absolutely not. But 50 million is where that floor sits. So at 53 million, this is kind of flirting with the guidelines of what's available for us to write about. It does come with a 9% yield, though, which is kind of catching my eye at the moment. In terms of where the portfolio trades, it's either 25% if you agree with my calculations, or about 30% if you agree with someone else's below net asset value. In this case, I said last week was Supermarket Income REIT. I thought that was significant because they were selling properties. In this case, I don't really care very much. Their last disposal they made was, I think, mostly in the name of just servicing their balance sheet. They did sell it above net asset value slightly as a hotel up in Glasgow. But their portfolio is fully occupied and they collect their full rents. And what are their properties? All kinds of different things, from care homes to hotels to student accommodation to nurseries to petrol stations to car showrooms. This is what we call a diversified REIT. I checked, and one of their properties is in a place that's somewhere near Hull. I can't quite tell exactly how to pronounce it. It's a care home in a place that I want to pronounce Brough. But it's Brough. Steve, anywhere close?
Yeah, that's Brough. Yeah,
Brough.
I've heard people in Brough like to be referred to as Brow, but it's not as Brough.
Okay, fair enough. So if you come from there, or if you just like it, Brough, then you might be interested in this stock and the kind of things that we have. So 97% of that portfolio is linked to inflation in terms of rent increases. So that will work its way higher gradually over time, assuming that Inflation keeps happening, which I think it will, and it makes a reasonable hedge against that. In terms of their kind of sector distribution, they're about 25% of their income, not necessarily their number of buildings, but if you think about it by their rental income, 25% of that comes from Steve's favourite REIT sector, which is industrial. About 17% comes from healthcare one way or another. I think that's mostly care homes, so that's mostly stands to benefit from an aging population, I think, along the way. Let's talk about the other things we normally talk about here then. So the average time to first break on their lease contracts is 17 years. That's probably fine. Rent collection seems unlikely, 100% collection. Rent collection failures seem unlikely. They're 100% occupied and 100% collecting at the moment. So the question becomes, what about their own debt? Because they do have some. They have about $41 million on a loan from Canada Life, obviously the UK REIT funder of choice. They're currently paying about 3% on. 3% is all right on about $41 million. The trouble is that has about 2 years left to run, and then it comes due. They have a choice here, I guess. They can either sell something, or probably quite a bit of stuff, to be honest, given the value of their portfolio, to try and service that and pay it back. I wouldn't like to see them do that. Or they can refinance it. And if they refinance it 2 years ahead, what sort of rate are we looking at? Well, we could be looking at somewhere in the region of 5 to 6%, so around double at the moment, which is not great, but is probably not a disaster. So they have about $6.9 million in operating income, and they're currently paying out 5% would boost their outgoings from in interest, sorry, from about $1.4 million to about $2.1 million. So it would add another 50% to it, but it would still be way under their kind of operating income levels. Added to that, they continue to increase their rents. I think they'll get some way towards offsetting this a bit. You might see a slight decline in that case, but I think it would probably stay fairly flat, which brings me to my usual thought about REITs. I'm wary about their ability to grow in pretty much every case, because they either do it by taking on debt or they do it by issuing equity because they can't hold on to their cash. At the moment, with a 9% yield, I'm not convinced this does need very much growing. This has been a theme of the three REITs that I've talked about from the UK fairly recently, and indeed with Realty Income to an extent. I wouldn't buy one of these things on the assumption that it will grow. That said, the growth, opportunity set looks quite different here to either Realty Income or any of the REITs I've talked about before. So this is a diversified operation, which means it does kind of, that has puts and takes from what I can see of it, but the benefit probably comes on the growth side. So if you're a primary health properties or a supermarket income REIT, I think the UK can only hold so many primary health properties and supermarkets. There is going to be a finite limit to that, especially in supermarket income REIT's case. Growth is going to be hard. Building out that portfolio is going to be hard. In the case of a diversified REIT, though, you can pick up a variety of different properties along the way. You have far more opportunities available to you. Plus, this thing has a 53 million market cap. There's loads of scope to grow. Contra Realty Income, which is absolutely enormous and increasingly trying to do deals that it thinks size is an advantage for. But I think there are certainly cases where deals are going to be in general too small to make them any bigger. PSR is a slightly different story in the sense that house building seems to keep happening, so there's probably a decent supply of houses coming online going forward, even if we get a slowdown from construction output in a recession. That's the last of my REITs for the foreseeable future, Steve. I've had a decent time with these just lately. Over the last month or so, PRS is up 13%, supermarket income 13.5%, primary health properties 11%. No one should give me any credit for that whatsoever. I said I thought they looked cheap, but I didn't think they were going up anytime soon. What do you think of this, Steve?
So, I mean, I'm reading the annual report. It's the first time I've ever seen it, so you'll have to excuse me. But what an eclectic mix of real estate. Sort of, they've got like 19 properties.
Yep.
And it's pretty crazy. So they've got a massive residential building in Salford. They've got an industrial estate in St. Helens and Dudley. Then they've got a Premier Inn. A Mercure Hotel in Glasgow, which is a posh top-end hotel. And then we've got a Motor Point in Birmingham. We've got a couple of what look like care homes, a Travel Lodge, a B&M, Hoddesdon Energy Power Station, Hoddesdon, then the wonderful place in Brough, which is local. They've got a Volvo, a Pure Gym, a petrol station, and a Snap Fitness Centre in the middle of London. I got it. Just my worry with something like this is that how can you be the expert on all of those things? Do you know what I mean? I think that's the issue that I would have with this REIT straight off the bat, is looking at this 19 properties saying, I mean, there's education, leisure, automotive and petroleum, industrial, automotive, retail, hotels, healthcare, power stations. I just don't think across that amount of regions and that amount of areas you could be an expert in all of those areas. So it's either that the management are really, 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 really good at buying great properties all over the UK and have experience of doing so in various numbers of sectors, or that they're a bit willy-nilly with the purchasing and they're buying, whatever they can get their hands on. And that would be my main worry looking at this. But like I say, this is the first time I've ever heard of this company. And while you was doing it, I was just like flick reading through the report. In terms of their actual balance sheet, it doesn't look too bad. So whatever they've done has worked okay so far. I think they're quite fair in the way that they're valuing their buildings as well. They're not shying away from knocking down the value of those buildings, and also discussing about what they've sold and what they've bought. So it's a very good report, Steve, for such a small business. I think they spent a lot of money on putting this together and a lot of care and attention. So if people are interested in it, then the full annual report and financial statements is fairly up to date, 30th of June. It's definitely worth a flick through.
Yeah, 19 properties, you know, people that own more properties than that. But to your point, I said there were puts and takes to being diversified here. And I said one of the benefits is you have a bigger opportunity set. The take on that is exactly what you were sketching of. It's hard to be an expert in all of these sorts of areas. And you can get quite scattered in these things. And in general, thinking even more broadly than REITs for the moment, the market tends to agree with you. On that thought, the market likes, in on the whole, and it depends on what it is, right? If it's coal, then less so, but the market tends to like pure play things, and it finds it much more plausible to say, look, here's what we understand: supermarkets. We're going to go and buy and sell and lease supermarkets because we know more about supermarkets than the guy who's also worrying about care homes and industrial distribution centers in the same way. And I think there is some good plausibility to that. I mean, on the balance sheet, yeah, you can't run a massively levered balance sheet when you have a 53 million market cap and a portfolio that size. Your balance sheet has to be in decent shape there. It probably looks a lot more healthy than something like Realty Income's, but that's because it's a lot more fragile as a business, right? Realty Income loses a tenant, you don't notice, basically. It takes off less than 1% of their rental income. You lose a tenant off of 19, and you're looking at a big lump out of things. So there is intrinsically more risk with going smaller here. There's arguably more opportunity in terms of growth, but that doesn't really make much sense in terms of a REITs. So I'm not looking at it that way. I think what I look for when I think REITs, I think pretty defensive operations. I'm not really a dividend investor, to be honest, but if someone offered me a good enough one, I'm not enough of an anti-dividend investor to not take it, I think. And that's kind of why I've been looking at this sort of real estate sector in general over the last however long. This is the last one, though, I promise.
Yeah, it's about total return, isn't it? You're looking at dividends in isolation versus looking at something there that you think, well, look, this company could grow from here, but realistically, if it stays roughly how it is and grows rent with inflation and grows the dividend with it, then 9% is a great return to start from. So when you're looking at a 9% return, you can often think, well, if I'm losing 9% share price here, then it's absolutely pointless. But with something like this, you would hope for stability and a return in that regard. So shall I shoot on to Tencent?
Yeah, let's talk about Tencent.
Okay. So I haven't had a chance to convert it all back from yuan to dollars, but you can divide all these by 7, and I'll keep out of the trillions because that will just make it too confusing. So everything you hear here, if you want to go back to dollars, which is a more familiar currency, just divide by 7. So revenue was 154.6 billion. That's up 10%. Gross profit, 76.5 billion. That was up 23%. That's a 49% gross margin. Net income was 45.8 billion, which is up 37%. 65 billion in operating cash flow, up 59%. That's a 42% margin. And 51.1 billion in free cash flow. That's up 85%. That's a 33% margin. In terms of segment, value-added services is one of their segments, Steve. That was revenue $75.7 billion. That's up 4%. I had a look at what that is. It's domestic games, international games, communication and social, and digital content. So they split this down a little bit for us. So value-added services revenue for social was minus 0.4%, 29.7 billion yuan. Value-added services revenue for domestic games was 29.7 billion. Value-added services revenue for international games was 13.3 billion plus 14%. Online advertising revenue, 25.7 billion plus 20%. And fintech revenue was 52 billion plus 16%. In terms of business metrics, monthly active users for WeChat was 1.34 billion, up 0.7% Q on Q. QQ Mobile was down 2% to 558 million Q on Q. And fee-based value-added services subs was up 2% to 245 million Q on Q. So none of those stats are bad. They may sound quite low. QQ is a slight move away, but value-added subs up 2% quarter-on-quarter is good because that's 8% annualized, obviously, 0.7 on WeChat, which is already a very, very... it's got its tendrils everywhere in China, so for that to be still growing is impressive. Net cash position, Steve, was 36.4 billion. Market cap, this is the only one I'm going to refer to in trillions, but it's 3.1 trillion, so divide that by 7 to get somewhere near your dollarage. In terms of the call, there was loads of interesting information here, and again, I've pulled out far too much, but they said that we achieved a solid and high-quality revenue growth, notable margin expansion, and structural operating leverage. Relatively new services, such as our video accounts and minigames, contribute higher margin revenue streams, and we have refocused away from less scalable activities. Value-added services, stable revenues was plus 4%, and they said that this was stable year-on-year. Revenue from music and games-related live streaming services decreased, while revenue from music subscriptions and mini-games increased. They said that advertising growth slowed due to a higher e-commerce mix, but they see a lot of opportunities to increase the ad load in search. So with that, businesses like this that have old and new parts to it, we always say to look for the flywheel, and the flywheel's growing in advertising. I think 20%, let me just double-check that. Advertising is growing at 20%. It's already at 25.7 billion and they're looking at increasing the ad load there, so expect that flywheel to keep spinning at least for a decent period of time. The fintech is currently benefiting from having a payments arm built onto it, and they've also built wealth management in as well, so they're sustaining teens year-on-year growth rate on this, and it's benefiting from an increased commercial payment activity and a wealth management aggregated consumer assets customer assets section as well. So they're increasing investment in AI, Steve. They said they're increasing their investment in AI models, providing new features to our products and enhancing targeting capabilities for both our content and our advertising. We aspire to position our leading AI capability not only as a growth multiplier for ourselves, but as a value provider for our enterprise customers and society at large. They're moving from messaging to social networking to Opal platforms and video accounts. This was basically saying that the old service was a messaging service essentially, and they've since grown on that to being a bit more sort of wider based service, and they're still way in the middle of that transition. So they said that video account advertising monetization is high margin and has a very long growth runway. This is essentially their TikTok come YouTube sort of competitor. It's all part of the super app, and they think that it's only really at the very beginning of its growth. So they're making Tencent Hunyuan available. It's a proprietary foundation model, Tencent Hunyuan. And they've made the bot available, which is what it is essentially, to a smaller but expanding number of users via a mini program. It's basically now powering things like meeting summarization in Tencent meetings. And it also does content generation in Tencent Docs, which are essentially like PowerPoint and like Word, I guess. They're enabling enterprise customers to utilize a large language model via an API, which is essentially what OpenAI is. And they're using a model as a service solution for cloud functions such as coding, data analysis, and customer service automation. So we see a lot of that in the US with things like Copilot, etc., things like that. So they said that their AI is getting better at targeting, better at content creating and better at coding efficiency. And they gave some examples of that in the call if you want to go and listen to it. They also said that they've got one of the largest AI chips in China, and they were one of the first companies to put in for NVIDIA's H800s, which is the new NVIDIA chip. And they've got enough for a couple of generations, and they're not actually currently affected by the ban on shipping to China, which was quite interesting. I thought they would be. They're actually thinking about trying to resell AI chips down the road as well, which just sound to me like they're about to get covered by the ban. But they were looking at sort of these chips. They were calling them training chips and using them for training purposes and how to make them more efficient. So there was quite a lot of interesting bits on AI. They think that this is going to lead to a high quality revenue growth and better operating leverage model just for the business at whole. So they said there's three drivers of their current operating leverage, because we saw that in the operating cash flow and free cash flow numbers. They're growing impressively. But they said revenue mix shift, they're exiting their non-core businesses, they're cutting back on excessive spending and general cost discipline. So I think we saw that in the quarter. You can see that in the figures. There's definitely been a heightened focus on cost discipline. They're seeking to continuously improve operational efficiency, thoughtfully allocate headcount, so sacking people, and effectively managing marketing expenses to maintain a focused organization with a lean cost structure for the future, which I think, again, you're seeing in the figures. They said that in terms of games, they have a strong and defensible franchise in competitive multiplayer games because of their sort of flagship and evergreen game policy. And said that their gaming strategy was built in on keeping these sort of flagship evergreen games and not on games that have quick product cycles or require like yearly rejuvenation. And to point this out, they said that in the recent esports games, 4 out of 7 of the games that were being contested were all Tencent games. Well, 4 of the 7 were Tencent games, and that was, for anybody who cares, Arena of Valor, Peacekeeper Elite, League of Legends, and FC Online. I'm not sure I really know many of those. I know League of Legends, obviously, but I don't know the others. The last couple of bits, Steve. So Tencent's playbook was building a live streaming commerce. So now they've got the short video franchise. They want to start building a live streaming, a sort of gaming, sort of Twitch service, and franchise that. From live streaming, they reckon they can establish the tools and connection to supply chains of merchants and then build up live streaming e-commerce. So I think the playbook in this area is pretty well developed, and it's something they're looking into. And they reckon that they, as we said before, Steve, it's a bit of playing the hits with Tencent, because they've got this multi-pronged growth model that they take from different businesses. And when they don't want to do something in a sector, they take a piece of a business that does. So that was basically their key bits from the call. I had a good look at it, Steve, and I think what I've always said about Tencent is at times I find China uninvestable, but I've gripped my teeth and carried on investing through it. I think playing the hits, as Bill Mann once told us, is the way to do it. Tencent is the hit. It's the top dog in China for gaming, for advertising. Its macro and regulatory problems seem to have turned for the better. I think the government seems to be a little more supportive, a little less murky, I would say. Growth is returning for Tencent. Earnings growth is accelerating. There's green shoots across all of their commerce, across their advertising. This is a far better business than it was a couple of years ago. And again, Steve, because we're doing it, I did a reverse DCF on it again, and this needs high single-digit growth in free cash flow over the next 10 years to make sense, which when you're growing at 85% year-on-year in terms of your free cash flow, that is very achievable.
Working backwards for a moment, I'm surprised it even needs that, to be honest with you. I was converting that 3 trillion market cap back to dollars. Well, I had a go and I came up with slightly the wrong number. I came up with about 400 billion. Actually converts back to, maybe it's because I use a slightly rough number of 7, but it actually comes out at 389 billion, which is about the size of Walmart in terms of market cap. So compare that against Tencent and you get all the things that you just described, a kind of just start with WeChat for the moment then, for the time being, which is basically what apps in the US and so on ought to be if someone got hold of them and did them properly, which I think Elon's trying to do with Twitter, but he might find that harder work with other things in the way. But just that, with a gigantic Chinese domestic market, which is kind of difficult to overstate how big that is. It's not impossible, obviously. Statistically, it's not impossible. But you have that in a giant market, plus a load of gaming stuff, plus a load of social media stuff, a YouTuber-like thing. And you get all that lot for 400 billion, which is around the size of Walmart in the US. A different type of business, obviously. The thing is still growing pretty well. The big keep getting bigger there. I think this is a company where its size really does help it kind of work out well in terms of having options into on sort of buy versus build versus develop and so on. I was surprised this even needed kind of single digit growth. And the thing that surprised me even more was that thing you said about chips. If they've got a chip advantage over the rest of the Chinese thing, they are absolutely made here, because I read the other day that Alibaba, obviously other big Chinese conglomerate, was planning to spin itself out into six, basically to try and help these individual, or make these individual businesses kind of compete harder as pure play things. And they've had to postpone their cloud division. The reason being, their cloud division competes with things like Amazon Web Services, like Microsoft Azure and so on. And they can't get hold of the kind of chips they need from NVIDIA to try and power that. So they've cancelled that spin-off, at least. Well, I say cancelled. Postponed for the time being, with no specified date as to when that's going to happen. So if Tencent also have a kind of shiny NVIDIA AI powering chip type thing, that's going to be a huge advantage for them looking forward as well. And I was kind of caught by that when I heard it.
They had mentioned that they also have, even if they were to face the ban, they have the largest inventory of H800 AI chips in China anyway. They have enough, they reckon, for at least the next few generations of this AI bot that they're trying to create. So it sounds like they have a huge, huge stock of H800s. So even if they do get banned, that's not going to be a problem for them.
Yeah, so that's impressive resilience, I guess. And I suppose I was sort of mildly impressed at the kind of 10% revenue growth, working our way down leads to 23% gross profit increases and so on and so forth. Good to see them getting bigger. I'm not at all surprised to find that they're kind of horribly undervalued. I still think Chinese stocks are massively unloved, and it's not like there's no reason at all for that. You said you yourself kind of go backwards and forwards between thinking this is investable and this is not. You mentioned Bill Mann, who I think also, by the way, goes backwards and forwards between thinking China is uninvestable and China is the bargain of the century, because it's basically one of the two. And there's a lot of quote-unquote value investors who are really bullish on China, and they may well turn out right, but I'm not sure their reasons for being bullish are terribly good. They appear to be running a kind of version of a, this would be really bad, therefore it won't happen argument. And I don't think that argument's sound. And the more the world goes on, the more I see, or at least I think I see, kind of counterexamples to this all over the place of, no, turns out really bad things can and do happen. And I think that kind of lazy complacency is what gets people kind of burned in various ways of, oh, but they won't let that happen because why would they? Well, there's currently a chip ban on when it's not like things are all automatically going to sort themselves out, even if everyone agrees, including the parties involved, that the world would be a better place if the US and China had good trade relations, because they are the two kind of biggest superpowers around. Of course, it makes sense for them to get on. Charlie Munger runs a version of this, from what I can see of it. It is ridiculous that either side should want to just annoy the other one in this. Either way around, don't mind which way you want to think of it. I'm not entirely convinced that means they're going to do the right thing here. This comes all the way back to the sort of macro stuff when we think about what people ought to do with interest rates and what they will do. And there is a real danger of trying to read one off the other, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you there, Steve. You went over the point, exactly the point that I was going to make, that just because China and America probably should cooperate, and if they did cooperate, I think we'd see a massive expansion in global growth. That doesn't mean that they're going to cooperate with each other. Although Xi and President Xi and Biden's meeting at the in the middle of the week seem to have gone very well, and they seem to have been able to agree on some things. So perhaps, Steve, this is the first step of many where we get to a scenario where at least they have a healthy cooperation. And I mean, for starters, turning on the military communication with each other is a starter. So they shoot each other down and accidentally send spy balloons into each other's territory and things like that. So that's all positive, Steve. And let's hope that this is, for investors' sake anyway, that this is the beginning of some better cooperation.
It would be great if it is, wouldn't it? I mean, if they could find a way to kind of sort out the sort of compliance issues around stocks and so on, that would be even better for investors. I'm a little bit kind of mindful that there's an election coming again next year, though, in the US, and this may or may not be Biden's thing to sort out a year from now. We will see, I suppose. But that pretty much brings us to the end of what's been a slightly longer than usual show. Sorry, not sorry. We've enjoyed it quite a lot, and there's been lots of interesting stuff to talk about. As usual, I thought this one was going to come in around the 40-minute mark, but then when we got through half an hour or so of stuff that we consumed that we thought was good and interesting, and hopefully you guys enjoyed, that was clearly never on the table. But for now, we will see you next week. Bye now from Steve and Steve.